science. And most important of all, an abiding, almost debilitating concern for children. We were allies. The way I cared about our kids in Flint, he cared about kids everywhere. And he knew they were in danger. He could see colossal lead and water problems in cities all over the country. And he could see that they weren't being addressed. Trust. For me, it took only a few minutes to develop. Edward's philosophy was not just about righting wrongs. It was broader and bigger. He was a deeply moral person, and he wouldn't be a bystander to injustice. He was in Flint because he took it as his duty. Solving a public health crisis should have been the business of the people we'd empowered and entrusted and funded with our tax dollars to keep our air and food and water supplies safe, and not left to an out-of-state engineering professor or a pediatric residency director. But for Edwards, it wasn't a choice. He and Elon started talking about water engineering stuff. It was water geek jargon, almost incomprehensible to me. I understand medicine and science, but the technical engineering lingo is slightly out of my comfort zone. Percentage of water leaks, types of corrosion inhibitors, disinfectant byproducts. I kept peering into my bag, looking down at the copy of my clinic results, the preliminary numbers. I wanted so badly to show him or tell him. I thought about Jenny. Would she have been able to resist this moment? I looked at Elon, who knew what I had in my bag, as did Dean Dean. But rather than say anything, I asked a hypothetical. What if someone looked at the blood lead levels and saw an increase after the water switch? Would that make a difference? Without a pause, he spoke with total confidence. That would be a game changer. Elon and Dean Dean and I shared a look. I tried to catch my breath, while Mark, because he was Mark to me now, not Professor Edwards, began talking again about how the most vulnerable children are babies on formula, because it is most often mixed with tap water. The proper ratio of powder to water is 1 scoop for every 2 ounces of water. But some new moms found it confusing and diluted the formula with too much water, sometimes on purpose, hoping to make it last a little longer. Watery formula can result in poor growth, low sodium, and sometimes even seizures. Now on top of those concerns, in Flint at least, adding more water also increased an infant's exposure to lead. There were ready-to-feed formula options, something I mentioned to Mark, who seemed very interested and asked for more information. He was an incredible listener, always leaning in closer. I explained that the ready-to-feed formula came in bottles and was already mixed, no water needed, but it was also more expensive and not usually covered by federal food programs for the poor. This got us brainstorming. Was there a way to get the ready-to-feed formula to Flint babies? We talked about getting a waiver from the USDA to give out ready-to-feed formula at the clinic. Elon mentioned that she might try Representative Kildee's office for help with that. As the lunch was coming to an end, and totally out of the blue, in sort of a non sequitur, Mark blurted out the words, "I trust you," to me. He hadn't been sure he could when we first set up the meeting. He assumed we were cut from the same cloth as the other public health folks who'd undermined his work and kept lead in water for years. But to his surprise, he'd come to Steady Eddie's and found allies. And I had a new friend. I ran back up to clinic. Sometimes I still can't get over the fact that I work above a farmer's market. And quickly sent an email to the folks who run the Genesee County Health Department's Women, Infants, and Children, WIC, program, which provides pregnant moms and young kids with nutritional support. Could they help us get ready-to-feed formula? I thought of little Nicola, now on her 4th week of powdered formula. The clock was ticking, not just for her, but for all the babies in Flint. If there was ever a time I wished we had more breastfeeding moms, it was now. Babies who are drinking formula mixed with tap water, especially warm tap water, are at greatest risk for lead exposure, I wrote. Water is such a huge proportion of their diet and their brains are still developing. Until we have definitive information about lead exposure, we should err on additional prevention, especially for our most vulnerable kids. I received a response that they were concerned, but don't have the means to provide either water or vouchers. Angry, I texted Elin to see if she could follow up with Jordan in Kildee's office, hoping he could pressure the USDA to provide ready-to-feed formula now. She did. And Jordan tried, but was told that the USDA couldn't do a waiver unless there was actually a health advisory or official emergency. So that was it. We were back in the bizarro world of the Kehoe Rule, where we had to prove there was danger and harm before anything could be done. The onus was on us. I summarized my lunch meeting in a long email to Melanie. Thanks to all my talks with Elin and now Mark, I felt like I had taken a crash graduate school course on lead and water. We're facing a disaster, I wrote. It could be seen a mile away, but now that it's in our faces, we have to act, and soon. Melanie responded quickly. She thanked me for the recap and said she was already thinking about the next steps. Then she said the magic words. I want us to be part of the solution. That night at home, Elliot was happy to hear how the meeting had gone and how Melanie had responded. After he fell asleep in the recliner in the corner, I opened my laptop. It was still September 15th, after all. Even without Mark Edwards, the meetings, the emails, and the submission of the IRB application, it was one of the biggest days of the year for me. It was the day ARIS opened. ARIS is the Electronic Residency Application Service, which transmits medical student applications to prospective residency programs. So on September 15th, we learned who has applied to become a resident at Hurley Medical Center. The fruit of all my work during the year ripens, and I can see who is applying to our program. Every year, we want more and better applications. In recent years, since we had been working hard to upgrade the program, we were up to 1,300 or so applications per year. That number is whittled down to a list of 200 applicants whom we invite for interviews to fill our 7 slots. I'm the one who does the whittling. As soon as ARIS opens, I start searching for the best applicants. In order to get a running start, I try to read 100 applications a day between September 15th and the end of the month. When I came to Hurley, the pediatric residency program was falling apart. Some unhappy residents were transferring out. Now, with a revamped curriculum and several key hires, mostly women faculty, our morale was fantastic. Our residency theme song was taken from the Lego movie, Everything is Awesome. We were attracting a more competitive and diverse group of residents, ones who increasingly looked like our patients. They came from all over, caring, idealistic, and passionate new docs who wanted to change the world. And they wanted to live and work in Flint, which shows how dedicated they are. Lying in bed, I began reviewing applications. But it was hard to turn any of them down. I loved them all. How could I not? With my laptop open on my bed, I quickly fell asleep. The next day, our IRB application was approved. We had submitted it on Tuesday, and it was approved on Wednesday. An unheard-of turnaround time. Hurley may not have dozens of NIH-funded researchers and an entire building dedicated solely to research, but we don't have the sputtering and stalling bureaucracy that often comes with all that either. We are small and lean and responsive. Everyone knows everyone, and the credibility that Jenny and I had built over the years carried weight. Mona, Jenny teased me, has anybody ever said no to you? After 2 weeks of hearing no from everyone I spoke to, I could only laugh. Chapter 14. Environmental Injustice. With the IRB approval letter in hand, Jenny and I now could access the blood lead levels obtained by other clinics and doctors in Flint, at least all the labs processed at Hurley. In a matter of minutes after we submitted our data request, at exactly 7:53 a.m. on September 17, 2015, our IT department sent us a full data set pulled from the Epic electronic medical records. We went from a sample size of about 350 to one of almost 2,000. Before EMRs, this kind of study would have taken months, possibly years. It would have been painstaking work, reviewing paper chart by paper chart by hand. An analysis still took time now, but getting the data itself took only minutes. I didn't know what the exact results would be, but waiting wasn't an option. About 10 minutes after looking over the new data set, without permission or even hesitation, I blasted out an email advisory to my residents and faculty at Hurley. My biggest concern was the babies, who were the most vulnerable. I sent out a set of instructions for the clinic to provide to all the moms and dads and other caretakers. All. There has been a lot of news recently about the possibility of lead in the city of Flint water. Until more information is garnered, I think it would be best to take some precautions for our most vulnerable patients. Babies on formula consume a huge amount of water. So at your clinic visits and in the newborn nursery, please continue to recommend, 1, breastfeeding. And 2, if using formula, do not mix with tap water, and especially not with warm tap water. This was the best I could do for now. I knew I had to do something, even though no one at the state or county health department seemed particularly interested in the subject of lead in the water, or had done much to take action. Never mind that I was a lifelong progressive and believer in government, and was quickly losing faith. A sea of red tape lay between me and an official health advisory, which would hopefully free up resources and qualify the city for bottled water, filters, and other aid. For the 100th time, I wondered, is the official indifference because these are Flint kids? Poor kids? Black kids? Kids who already have every adversity in the world piled up against them? I was getting really mad. At times, I could feel myself physically shaking. Luckily, I had two meetings on my calendar that day. At the first one, I had a chance to see my old friend, Kirk Smith, CEO of the Greater Flint Health Coalition, GFHC, which was leading a new community-based initiative called Children's Healthcare Access Program, CHAP, to improve healthcare access and reduce medical costs for kids. I was on the planning committee of CHAP, which had just gotten funded by a grant from the United Way. Our meeting was to discuss implementation. United Way runs a program called 211, through which people can obtain free information and support for essential health and human services around the clock via phone or website. It connects people in need with critical services that save lives and support health. But CHAP was going to take 211 a step further. Instead of just referring a child who needs a car seat to a resource, CHAP would then call that family back and make sure they got the car seat and offer them transportation services, social work services, and enrollment in other eligible programs. But there were things to sort out. What should CHAP take on? Where should we start? We decided to pilot the program in the handful of pediatric clinics that see the most Medicaid kids in Flint. Hurley was 1 on that list. Kirk ran the meeting skillfully, raising several concerns and ideas, while the rest of us, a couple of local pediatricians, a school nurse, an asthma management specialist, and Health Coalition staff chimed in. We were joined by Dr. Reynolds, who was serving as the medical director for the program, a totally volunteer position, and Jamie Gaskin, the CEO of Genesee United Way, whom I had never met before. When the meeting ended, I got up slowly, gathered up my laptop, coffee, and phone, and made my way over to Kirk. "The water situation is not good," I said. "Tell me more," he said. "I'm looking at the lead levels in Flint kids' blood." Then I shared some of my research, just enough. Kirk and I had gone through the same public health program more than a decade ago, and he had known me long enough to know that I am never inflammatory or impulsive. But I am passionate and expressive. He was studying my face, which had become a roadmap of anxiety. I'm getting nowhere with the county and state, I said. They keep blowing me off. While standing, I forwarded him the emails I had sent to the county and the state. He sighed. Dr. Reynolds wandered over and joined our chat in a corner of the boardroom. Then Jamie Gaskin from United Way came over and listened in. Somebody mentioned having seen that water guy from Virginia Tech on TV. I met with Mark Edwards, I said. All eyes turned to me. He's the real deal, as far as I can tell. And the testing he's doing shows very high amounts of lead in the tap water. Very high. I could see Kirk's mental wheel spinning. Then Jamie Gaskin spoke up. He lived in Flint and had a 7-year-old son. Within a span of only minutes, he was talking about solutions, distributing bottled water and obtaining filters. Then I raised my most serious concern, the powdered formula mixed with tap water. The only solution was getting someone to declare a state of emergency or issue a health advisory, which we hoped would kick into gear a number of governmental responses, including bottled water deliveries, water filters, and maybe pre-mixed baby formula. But nothing could happen without this official action. We talked about the quickest way to get it done. I said that I was in touch with Representative Kildee's office, and a staffer there was working with the USDA angle for pre-mixed formula. What other options were there? Kirk and Dr. Reynolds were as worked up and engaged as I'd ever seen them. They were talking twice as fast as usual, interrupting each other and tossing out new ideas at a breathtaking pace. Kirk was writing things down in his little notebook, and Jamie was channeling his frustration into action. I could also see that I wasn't alone anymore. A team was coming together. That night, as luck would have it, I dropped in on a hotbed of pediatricians, the perfect place to find more supporters. The annual meeting of the MIAAP was just beginning. At the board meeting that first night, after a few opening remarks, the agenda was to discuss the dismal immunization rate in the state of Michigan and some solutions to improve it. There were about 10 pediatricians on the board, including me. I am passionately pro-vaccination, and convincing parents to have trust in the science on vaccines is one of the most important tasks facing pediatricians today. Combating this dangerous trend of science denial, I always explain to my patients the concrete evidence about vaccine safety and efficacy, literally how many millions of lives have been saved, and I share that I have no hesitation immunizing my own daughters. I was called on to describe a press conference that I had attended as a representative of the MIAAP a month earlier for a back-to-school immunization campaign throughout the state. I delivered a quick summary of that event, then remembered that at that conference, I had met the new chief medical officer for the Michigan Health Department, Dr. Eden Wells, a sensible, no-frills woman who also directed the University of Michigan's Preventative Medicine Fellowship. Since doctors would be talking about the importance of vaccination at the press conference, I brought my white coat, even though I'm usually reluctant to wear it, or scrubs for that matter, outside the clinic or hospital. Flaunting the white coat is something only medical students and new doctors do, but I was supposed to give media interviews that day on camera, where the white coat screams credibility. Eden told me she was sorry she didn't think to wear hers. She also noted that, in addition to the Hurley children's logo, my white coat had an MSU green S. She teased me about being a Spartan while she was a Wolverine, rival schools. Remembering that encounter got me thinking about the health department and made me wonder again about Karen Lyshinsky, the agency's lead poisoning nurse. 6 days had passed since I'd reached out to her, but I still had received no reply. Lead colonized my mind again. While the rest of the MIAAP board discussed vaccination rates, I kept thinking about blood lead screening rates. How many Flint kids who were required to get a Medicaid-mandated screening, I wondered, actually got one? The number of at-risk kids who never got screened would dramatically impact our sample, as well as the findings. The more I learned, the more I saw how wrong-headed the public health approach to lead was. It was ass backward. When we test a child for lead, we are testing the child's environment. children become the proverbial canaries in the coal mine. As we use their bodies, their lives, as instruments to test the world around them. If they test high, that means there's lead in their environment. This is useful to know, but for the child, it's already too late. Primary prevention means preventing harm from occurring before a child moves into a house, before a mom gets pregnant. A truly visionary program would be methodically identifying and eliminating the lead from our environments completely before a child is exposed. As the board meeting came to a close, the MIAAP executive director asked if anyone on the board had something else to share, a concern or development. It was late. People were packing up. I looked around. No hands were going up. I blurted it out, my heart pounding. Well, we may have a lead problem in Flint. I was sitting in a room with the leading pediatricians in the state, after all. These were my peeps. If I had to go public, this was the place. All heads turned to me, awaiting more information. As briefly as possible, I explained the history of the water issue, and I knew one story would drive it home. I told them how GM had stopped using the water a year before because it was corroding engine parts, but we were still expecting the kids of Flint to drink it. I said we were looking at blood lead levels at the Hurley Children's Clinic, and our findings were concerning. I knew not to share numbers or describe much else beyond saying that we were currently analyzing a larger data set. A long silence fell over the room. I didn't want to alarm them, not yet, so I just repeated that we were still looking at the numbers, but I was concerned. I looked around the room and met the eyes of the other pediatricians. Pediatricians seem to wear compassion on their sleeve and have trouble hiding emotions. Without needing any further explanation, they knew what was at stake. I could see that in their eyes. Denise Sloan, the executive director, said she had just spoken with Dr. Reynolds about possible topics for our advocacy lunch on Saturday. He had mentioned Flint's water too, and suggested that we raise the subject on Saturday with the larger group of pediatricians in attendance. Sounds good, I said. I won't have any numbers to share, but I would like to strategize. The next day, I attended the all-day MIAAP conference on toxic stress and later had no memory of most of it. Sitting in a hardback chair in another characterless meeting room, I tried to pretend that I was watching the PowerPoint presentations on the big screen. I call it death by PowerPoint. But I could have been anywhere and nowhere. Every half minute or minute, my phone sounded or buzzed with a new text. I ignored the usual incoming tide of work-related stuff and pulled out anything from Kirk, Elon, Melanie, Dean, Jordan, Jenny, or Mark for immediate consideration. My attention went to Jenny first and foremost. We were furiously texting as we analyzed the data and going over and over the design of our study. We were facing a few crucial decisions. We couldn't decide what to do about children who had multiple blood lead levels. For the study, we needed only one level per child. But if a child was diagnosed with an elevated level, the protocol was to take their blood levels repeatedly. Should we use their highest lead level or their first lead level? The literature seemed to contain both kinds of examples. We were constantly going back to published research, reading article after article to see how other studies were done. After some reluctance, we decided to ask Mark for advice, to tap his scientific expertise. He didn't seem to answer texts, but he replied to emails almost instantly. He recommended that we use the highest blood lead level for each child. This was what he did when he looked at blood lead levels in DC. But more important, he emphasized that the fact that a child's first lead level may not be elevated does not protect him or her from future elevated lead levels. And looking over our study design, he questioned one aspect, the time frame. We had a comparison of levels before and after the water switch. While we used the same number of months, we didn't use the exact same months of the year. and that was a problem. Water lead levels are affected by heat and the seasons of the year. Lead in water peaks when the outside temperature is higher. That's why you're never supposed to use hot water from your tap. What? Crap. Of course seasonality was a factor. While I wrestled with anxiety from the possibility that I could have gotten other things wrong, Jenny and I moved quickly. We were facing another do-over. But what would have been a painstaking, time-consuming, and months-long endeavor just 5 or 10 years ago was a pretty quick undertaking. Due to advances in statistics software and algorithms for sorting and analyzing data, she was able to run the new study and send me the new numbers while I was sitting at a lecture at the MIAAP conference. I thought we had it right this time. We controlled for seasons, and we used the highest lead level if a child had more than one. I looked over the results. The number of elevated blood lead levels was still higher after the water switch. Markedly higher. It was clear. We had the proof we'd been looking for. Kids were being harmed every day, with every sip of water they drank, with every bottle of formula. I forwarded the preliminary results in an email to Mark. FYI, we changed pre- and post-dates to remove seasonal impact, and we used highest lead for duplicate leads. Elevated blood levels, percentage, for kids less than 5, 2.1% pre versus 4% post. P equals 0.024. We will soon break down to the higher risk zip codes where you saw higher water lead levels. Mark responded immediately. I'm ashamed for my profession. Mark would say those words many times in the coming weeks and months. He took the responsibilities of his engineering profession seriously and personally. Just as I knew without any doubt that pediatricians are entrusted with the health and welfare of children above all, Mark saw the main responsibility of water treatment experts, whether they worked at a utility, a city treatment plant, a state health department, a university, or the EPA, as providing safe drinking water, one of the central foundations of any society, from the humblest prehistoric settlement to modern nations. For him, what was happening in Flint wasn't just a Flint problem. It tarred his entire profession. During a break between lectures, Dr. Reynolds found me, and we walked out to a corridor to take a call from the Flint State Senator, Jim Ananick, who had heard news of my research. "Talk to Dr. Mona," Dr. Reynolds said to Senator Ananick. "She's the pediatrician doing the study." Then he turned his phone on speaker so we could do a mini-conference. "I just heard about the research you're doing," Senator Ananick said in a quiet, even tone. I didn't really know him. He was a burly, bearded guy with a reputation for being big-hearted and kind. He had grown up in Flint with Flint politics. His dad was a local city official who had died at a young age. "My staff has been prodding the state for more information about the water for months," he said. After Mark Edwards released his findings, they tried harder but still never got anywhere. They were told that Edwards was a quack, that he had baggage and grudges. They were told he was scaring Flint with invented numbers. "I've met with him," I said, "and his science is solid." I could hear the frustration rising in Senator Ananick's deep voice. "God, I am so sad to hear that. That's all the kids in Flint need, right?" "I know." "Can I ask a question about my new baby?" "Of course." "What should we be feeding him?" "Breastfeeding is the best option," I said. The senator responded with a long silence, then finally replied in a quieter voice, "That's not possible. He and his wife were foster parents, and were now trying to adopt the baby, who was on formula. He also mentioned that the baby was stuffy with a cold." "Get the ready-made formula," I told him. "It's pre-mixed with water. Or use only bottled water with the powdered formula. Use a humidifier for his cold. That will help with his congestion. but be sure to put bottled water in that too. Avoid anything coming out of the tap. As Dr. Reynolds and I walked back to the conference, both of us were fuming. He turned to ask me a question. "Have you heard about the concept of environmental injustice?" I nodded. "Of course. I studied with Professor Bunyan Bryant. More than 20 years ago, back when I was a tree-hugging environmentalist at the University of Michigan's School of Natural Resources and Environment, the legendary Bunyan Bryant was one of my early mentors. He was a pioneer of the environmental justice, EJ, movement, a movement that looked at environmental and public health issues through the lens of place, race, and poverty. Bryant was a Flint native, with family still there, and focused much of his research and advocacy on the city and its long history of polluting poor and brown neighborhoods. Bryan had even fought lead pollution in Flint decades ago, when a plant that burned lead-painted wood chips was built in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. As an undergrad, I took courses, listened to lectures, and participated in workshops led by Bryant and other EJ academic groundbreakers, like his colleague Paul Mohai. Bryant's work showed me how racial minorities and low-income communities faced a disproportionate share of environmental and public health burdens. Sitting in those EJ classes, I began to see that the environmental disparities I'd first witnessed in high school weren't random. The dirty incinerator we had fought so hard wasn't in Grosse Pointe or Birmingham, affluent suburbs. It was in Madison Heights, one of the poorer communities in our county. Bryant backed up his many examples of environmental injustice with hardcore research, showing how industrial waste, incinerators, trash dumps, and chemical plants were often located in neighborhoods where residents had fewer resources to fight them. Informed by these lessons, I dove into service learning, fieldwork, social justice organizing, and environmental health research. On one spring break, I went to maquiladoras in Mexico, where many of the auto jobs that had fled Michigan went, and saw that they were now troubled by the same pollution, poverty, and labor issues that pockmarked our history in Flint. Bryant's work stayed with me as I went off to study medicine and public health, and eventually when I came back to work in Flint. He was on my mind now more than ever. In lectures, Bryant had specifically called out the persistence of lead in paint and paint dust in black and brown and poor communities as a form of environmental racism. Bryant wasn't one to dwell on the problems. A central tenet of EJ is that local communities must have control over their environments and decide whether a pipeline gets a permit or a wind turbine gets built instead of a natural gas plant. When people have a say, smarter decisions are made, both for the environment and for public health. "Our Flint kids," I said to Dr. Reynolds, "already have higher rates of lead exposure, just like kids in Detroit, Chicago, Baltimore, and Philadelphia. And now, on top of all of that, they've got lead in their water to worry about." Lead shifts down the entire bell curve of intelligence, as Dr. Reynolds and I knew, not only adding more people with severely reduced intellectual capacity, but also reducing the number of exceptionally gifted people. We knew that lead is more prevalent in poor and minority communities, and thus lead exposure exacerbates our horrible trends in inequality and the too wide racial education gap. We knew that if you were going to put something in a population to keep people down for generations to come, it would be lead. "Environmental injustice," Dr. Reynolds said, shaking his head in disgust. "I know," I said. "Some things don't change." Chapter 15, Poisoned by Policy. Our goal was now clear: get a health advisory issued and alert the public. Kirk Smith at the Health Coalition knew the system, and he knew how to work it. And he knew that the first email should go to Howard Croft, the director of public works in Flint, I didn't know Croft. Honestly, I didn't even know there was a public works department or what it did. But on Thursday, after our meeting, Kirk began drafting an email to him, saying there was a concern that children in Flint had elevated blood lead levels and urgent action was required. Croft replied at 3:50 a.m., the middle of the night or early morning, depending on how you look at it. It was a truly remarkable demonstration of cover your ass and cluelessness all at the same time. The director of the DEQ has issued two official statements in the last 2 days contending that the city currently meets all federal and state standards, and we have noted that we are well ahead of our 2016 target for corrosion control. Blah, blah, blah. No urgency. No heightened concern. The rest of it was a bunch of long-winded, do-nothing, bureaucrat talk. It felt like a preemptive excuse. If the bubonic plague infected the state of Michigan, should we form a committee? The water had poison in it. The impact of lead is irreversible. They weren't using any corrosion control at the time, so Croft was lying about that. Or he had bought the lies being dished out by MDEQ. But I could ignore Croft for the moment because at 9:30 on Friday morning, the mayor, Dane Walling, emailed Kirk directly, wanting to talk. Croft had fortunately looped in the mayor, and now his office wanted all the information so it could respond, act accordingly. Kirk forwarded the emails. We were actually getting traction. Somebody was listening. Even if it was a mayor who had been politically neutered by the governor. He wasn't in charge anymore, but then neither was the governor's fourth EM. That position had been recently vacated, and decision-making power had shifted to Natasha Henderson, the Flint city manager. Even so, Walling had the title of mayor, which still must mean something. He was also a famous native son of Flint who could certainly attract a lot of attention to the water issue. If we got Walling on board, things could happen quickly. Kirk scheduled a meeting with Walling for Monday afternoon. The goal was to get a health advisory issued, which would kick into gear a number of governmental responses to the water problem, except we had absolutely no idea what authority was supposed to issue it. That gave me the weekend to finish my analysis and create a presentation for the mayor's office. Just 2 days to make 100% sure our numbers were right. 2 days. I was under the gun again. As soon as I filled in Jenny, we hunkered down and got in touch with Mark Edwards. We were taken by his obvious care for the kids of Flint and his eagerness to help, but I knew he had another side. His reputation for brusqueness and moral certitude was legendary. He had made enemies out in the world. So far, we'd only seen glimmers of this. For instance, Mark finally remembered that he had met Dean before, during the water wars in Lansing, an email to inform us that Dean had been an unhelpful dupe back then. But at the same time, here Mark was, being so generous and helpful to us. Jenny and I had worked on dozens of academic studies over the years, but putting together an utterly perfect and unassailable one in a matter of days, no less, was a bit of a leap. The pressure was intense. One minor error, even one that didn't affect the findings, would give critics the ammunition to undermine me. One minor error and all our efforts would be for nothing, and Flint kids would go on being poisoned. I was already out on a limb, and already being ignored. We had to produce a study that couldn't be. This is where Mark was crucial. He had done a similar study in D.C. of children's blood lead levels, and he knew what would make our study ironclad, flawless, and impervious to insult. We shared more results, how the increase was even greater in the zip codes where he had found the higher water lead levels. From Mona Hannah Tisha to Mark Edwards. Sent Saturday, September 19th, 2015, 10:23 p.m. Subject, preliminary results, confidential. FYI, all is still confidential, but we also ran EBL percentage for kids less than 5 years in the higher risk zip codes, 48503 to 48505. Pre, 1.7% to post, 5.3%. P-value less than 0.001. bad. We are really pushing for a health advisory so that we can get released necessary resources for high-risk kids. Thanks, Mona. He wrote back instantly. That pretty much nails it down. Stunning how fast you did it. The last event of the Michigan AAP meeting for me was Saturday's advocacy lunch. This luncheon group was larger than the board meeting, about 100 people, all pediatricians, and I knew many of them. The room was larger, another windowless conference room with round tables and so-so food. The best thing about being a pediatrician is that caring about kids, speaking for kids, and advocating for kids is an essential part of the job description. At a conference of surgeons or dermatologists, they might have a lunch theme like malpractice risks or how to maximize billing, but not pediatrics. That's why I've always felt at home in the specialty and with my colleagues. We don't just treat children's bodies, we fiercely protect their potential. Looking over my inbox of emails with Mark, I was starting to think we were not alone. 500 miles away from my clinic in Flint, in Blacksburg, Virginia, there was a guy in a very different profession who seemed to care as much as we did. As the lunch got underway, Dr. Reynolds told the crowd he'd been at home sick the week before when I'd called to discuss the Flint water. He invited me to explain my findings to the group. With more confidence than I'd had at Thursday night's board meeting, and armed with more details, I stood and shared my concerns with the pediatricians. We were looking at the data, I said, but preliminary findings were very troubling. We were building a coalition. I'd just gotten off the phone with our state senator's office. I was working with Representative Kildee's office, and I'd involved a nonprofit health coalition and the Genesee County Medical Society. The greatest obstacles so far were the county and state health departments. We needed their data, and they weren't sharing it. As soon as the lunch was over, a crowd of concerned pediatricians descended on me with expressions of disbelief and encouragement. My chair of pediatrics at MSU, Dr. Keith English, who was sitting next to me, leaned over and pledged to help. The other Mark in my life, my older brother, had been unusually absent lately. Normally we talked every week, sometimes every day, about our kids, our parents, what's happening in the news, and occasionally what's going on at work. Mark has always been wise for his age. His hair even started going gray in high school. I counted on him for advice, certainly anything halfway legal. Whatever was going on in our lives, we knew, without talking about it, that we had each other's backs. A partner at the successful public interest law firm in D.C. he helped start a few years ago, Mark is always fighting quixotic battles, some I never heard about, some I heard about later, after he'd won or lost. He fights on a different front, in a different place than I do, but wherever he is, Mark is fighting the same battles that I am, for the same people, the same ideals, the same reasons. He battles employers to recognize low-wage workers' unions, or he files suits on behalf of immigrant workers for wage and hour violations. He fights discrimination. He fights racism. He takes cases other lawyers won't, aggressively litigating in court for years and finding ways to win. It is part of the commitment to justice our parents hammered into us as children. But in late August, when I first heard the news about Flint water from Elon, Mark had been traveling. And after that, he was tied up settling a big case, representing sanitation workers who were being cheated out of overtime pay. I wasn't sure he'd been following the news in Flint, but knowing Mark, I suspected he was. We had our first chance to catch up on the weekend of September 19th, when he came with his family for his University of Michigan Law School reunion. I had the medical conference to attend, and Mark had reunion events, but I knew that sometime over the course of the weekend, amid the hubbub of a family gathering that included movies, a football game, and the usual platters of delicious food, thanks to Bibi, we'd find time to talk. Mark's wife, Annette, and I had been friends at the University of Michigan and classmates at the School of Natural Resources and Environment. She'd met Mark at a party I threw. Over the years, Elliot and Mark had become close, almost like brothers. To make things even better, Mark and Annette's two boys are about the same age as Nina and Layla. Our two families even spent winter breaks together, usually with Bibi and Jiddu. As usual, the first 48 hours together were almost completely about eating. Bibi had been cooking nonstop for days, making every dish Mark loved, especially spicy Iraqi curries. Elliot planned an outdoor movie night on Friday with a projector borrowed from our neighbors, using the garage wall as a movie screen. He ordered Buddy's Pizza from the Detroit chain, my brother's favorite, half meat, half vegetarian, jalapenos, and chopped basil on top, and cooked well done. Not that we needed to order out. On our last day of the gathering, when Bibi was exhausted from overcooking and all four kids were busy playing, Mark and Elliot and I sat around the dining table and began working on a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle that our friend Walter had given Elliot to pass the time during his shoulder recovery. Mark and Elliot and I are all jigsaw puzzle fanatics, but Elliot was clearly uncomfortable. He kept moving his shoulder, trying to find a better position, readjusting the splint, then seemed to resign himself to pain. He was the first to say something about the water. "Mark, I'm really worried about Mona. We both know she's tough, but she's been under a lot of stress lately." "Oh?" Mark kept his head down and was still moving the pieces scattered across the table surface and connecting some edges. "Even the girls have noticed how distracted she's been." "It's about the Flint water," I said. Mark began drilling, lawyer style, for details. He'd heard about the water. He'd been focused on the high cost and the resulting water shutoffs when residents couldn't pay their bills. Citizens went to the UN, charging that this was a human rights violation. I sketched out the lead issues, or tried to, quickly, starting with Elon and Mark Edwards. "He's the guy who uncovered the DC water crisis," I said. And in another indication of how that event had been covered up, or not covered enough, Mark had only a dim memory of it, even though he had been living in the district at the time and is one of the most politically aware and astute people I've ever known. Before becoming a labor lawyer, he had been a campaign organizer and a good one. I told him about the blood lead level data that Jenny and I had been studying and ran some ideas by him about how to make the most of it and make sure the state listened and took action. It didn't take him long to analyze the politics. Mark's assessment: Walling was up for re-election and, as the incumbent mayor, was closely associated with the water switch. This would hinder his appetite for finding a solution. Also, Walling's limited power flowed through Lansing, so he would be hard-pressed to take a risk by going against Snyder. So it was good for Flint that Senator Ananick, who was a friend of Mark's from college, was pushing the state for answers. Mark was thrilled to hear that Ananick and his wife had taken in a foster baby. He's going to be a fantastic dad. And relieved to hear that Ananick had joined the group that was coming together and backing me. "You'll need a good team," he said. Then he asked about Hurley and whether the hospital was behind me. I nodded. "It is a public hospital, right?" "Yes, owned by the city," I said. "Not many public hospitals are left. It's the only one of its kind left in the state." "So if the state has gone after every single person who has tried to expose the water problem, what makes you any different?" I had a group of puzzle pieces in front of me, all the same color. He had a point, and I just kept listening until he was finished making it. Mark's practice in recent years had shifted. Taking a page out of Hedgie's entrepreneurial playbook, he had taken a risk and started his own public interest firm with four friends on Labor Day, 2008, in the middle of the Great Recession. A substantial part of his work now included representing whistleblowers in complex corporate fraud cases, something I'd never really thought about until that moment. I didn't even think of myself as a whistleblower. So when he started talking about whistleblowing, pushback, retaliation, and other repercussions, he was speaking from experience. "I know you have your ducks in a row, but even if you are right, they still may try to take you down. They may go after you somehow," he said. "That often happens, or you might lose your job and your reputation." "I'm more concerned about the kids," I responded, "and letting everyone down." We continued working on the puzzle. The edges were almost finished, She's not eating or sleeping, Elliot said, sounding emotional. I could tell he was expressing concern that had been building up inside him. Unable to talk to me about it directly for some reason, he was doing it obliquely now, through Mark. I only wish I could do more to help. I hadn't considered the toll it was taking on him, not being able to say anything, or to help with something that was consuming me, taking up all my time. As for stress, I had to confess that it was worse than anything I'd ever experienced. Far more than my wedding, childbirth, losing my grandparents, buying a house and moving, or even my dad's heart attack. It was certainly worse than medical school examinations. Just so you know what's ahead, Mark went on, it could get rough. Many whistleblowers, even if they're successful in exposing fraud, have their lives destroyed. They become obsessed, sometimes paranoid, sometimes with good reason. And it's often a years-long fight. Many are retaliated against. I have clients who have lost their homes and friends, their marriages destroyed. One even killed himself. That's why I always counsel new clients, even though they're doing the right thing, that they need to seriously consider the costs. You have to be prepared for the worst. This made me think of the other Mark. His scars from the DC fight were obvious, and I wondered if he'd always have them. And it made me think of Elin, who predicted a years-long battle. Just then, Bibi appeared in the kitchen. No doubt she noticed that we were suddenly silent. I assumed she had heard some of Mark's cautionary words, which didn't help. "What's Mona up to now?" she asked in Arabic. "Nothing, Mama," I said. "Mona likes to get mixed up in things she shouldn't," she said. "It's nothing like that, Mama," Mark said. "Don't worry. Mona's strong. Hadida." The word means iron or steel. It's Arabic shorthand for tough as nails. As soon as she wandered off, Mark turned to me again, knowing he didn't have much time to finish before Bibi reappeared. He spoke more softly this time. "There are lots of risks, but it sounds like you're doing what you can to minimize them." "Trying to," I said. My worst fear was that I would be humiliated in front of my parents, Elliot and the girls, my extended family, my medical residents, my professional colleagues, and my friends. That I might make a monstrous mistake and blow it somehow, and look as if I were in over my head. I worried about being the idiot who yells fire in a crowded movie theater when there is no fire. There is an Arabic concept called ab, or shame. I always did my best to banish it from my brain because it's wrong and stupid and shouldn't be in my mind. But at the same time, it had been planted there so long ago. It was like a tumor that couldn't be completely excised. It had cells that kept mutating and replicating. Mark took a random puzzle piece from my hand and fit it into an empty spot, almost as if he were psychic and knew exactly where it belonged. "You know what you have to do." "Yep." "Because this isn't about what happens to you if you do something. This is about what happens or doesn't happen if you don't do something. This is what it means to be a member of a family, to have people in your life who trust you and support you and who know you sometimes better than you know yourself. Mark was there, my mom and dad were always there, and Elliot was always there, to stand with me no matter what was going down. What we had was more than love. We understood each other. We were grounded in the same core ideals and morals. And we're always moving toward the same goal, to make the world more just, more equitable, and a more human place. To do the right thing, even if it was hard. This wasn't about my career over the next few years, or even a tarred reputation. This was about how my entire life would look to me years from now, when I was Bibi's age or older. Mark knew that and was just reminding me that I knew it too. There was no way I could walk around Flint, watching kids grow into adolescents and then adults, and wonder if their problems were related to a poison that I hadn't done enough about. It wasn't a choice, really. I was ready to do whatever was needed. And now all I had to do was try to spend the rest of the weekend being real and present and not freaked out. That didn't happen. I had to finish my analysis, and start my presentation for the mayor. But somehow, we managed to finish the jigsaw puzzle on Sunday by the time Mark and his family left. Chapter 16. Shortwave Radio Crackling. If my dad had been around that weekend, we would have played Kunkan. We'd have been sitting around the same table, but instead of spending hours on the puzzle, we'd have been dealing out cards and eating fıstık, or pistachios. My dad loves an evening of Kunkan. We all do. Elliot, who grew up watching his own dad play the game, can sit for long stretches at the table, hand after hand. Mama Evelyn still comes and plays, and has taught all her great-grandkids the rules of the game, the way she taught Mark and me. And it's a truism in the family that if we play long enough, eventually, I will win everybody's money. But my dad, Jiddu, was still in China, working with the auto parts manufacturer. He enjoyed his time there, as well as his second career, post-retirement, making the most of his metallurgy expertise and his engineer's fascination for problem-solving. At 69, like my mom, he showed no interest in slowing down. Alloys and metals aside, he has lots of passions. For languages, international affairs, and history, he loves research most of all, digging into archives and making new discoveries. He spent untold hours obsessing over a Persian carpet that had been passed down in my mom's family, an early 1900s Karman rug depicting the great leaders of the world. Even when Haji was a boy, the carpet was never on the floor, but was hung on a wall, in a place of honor, and featured in family portraits. The rug was a puzzle. Not only did my dad decipher the Farsi key on the border of the rug to identify the historic figures, all men, of course, he worked with art historians and textile scholars to unravel the rug's origin and secrets. There was even a connection between the rug and Freemasonry and the Knights Templar. It was like the Da Vinci Code for carpets. Next, my dad focused on unlocking our family's ancestral puzzle. And that became his most successful side project to date. After a lot of persistence, he was able to prove that two family clans from two different villages in northern Iraq, El-Qosh and Tilkef, had been separated 300 years ago when one branch left its ancestral home to escape a plague. Over time, they lost touch. Any awareness of a relationship vanished. But now, because of my dad's discovery, which he has given many PowerPoint presentations about, the descendants of the Shekwana and the Qashshamun families, literally hundreds of people who have since scattered to every corner of the globe, have connected with cousins they didn't know they had, including us. What we never knew, until my dad's work, was our family's direct connection to a Nestorian priest named Israel Rabba of the Shekwana family. He was born in 1541, my grandfather, 12 generations removed. Israel Rabba and his family were famous scribes, known for their poetry and mystical literary work. They lived in an ancient monastery, Rabban Hermes, just outside El-Qosh, where they produced and guarded a library of intricately beautiful and painstakingly illustrated manuscripts. These manuscripts were used in church services, and some were also a form of rebellion. 500 years ago, my family, like many Chaldeans and Assyrians, ethnically the same people, were members of the Nestorian Church, or Church of the East, once the dominant Christian sect from the Mediterranean to India and China. As the Roman Catholic Church grew in power by converting people to its faith in the 1800s, the Nestorian liturgy and traditions were threatened. But some monasteries hid the scrolls in secret libraries, and priests transported them to safe places, so that around 200 of the Shekwana manuscripts are still in existence today in private collections, libraries, museums, and churches around the world. The Christian manuscripts remaining in El-Qosh and elsewhere had to be rescued again recently, in 2015, when ISIS encroached on the region. In nearby Mosul, ancient churches and shrines were destroyed, and hundreds of thousands of